This week, the Dow Jones Industrials and the S&P 500 finished at new all-time record weekly highs. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, back with you this weekend. We've got another big show lined up for you with top guests, including the editor of the Trends Journal, Gerald Celente, thinks that it's time to end the external entanglements and rebuild our country. That the 700-plus U.S. military bases located around the world might be a bit excessive, to say the least. Instead of suffering wounded limbs, minds, and hearts, our honorable troops need to be evacuated, returned home, and provided with adequate training to re-enter the modern workforce. As warriors of revival, the military can restore the crumbling domestic infrastructure and the economy. Although it will be costly, what he's termed Operation Occupy Peace will be offset by a sea change of improved opinion by the global community. American officials should take history lessons from the second largest economic superpower. China is following the original handbook of American success, building up the infrastructure, improving the country while increasing the number of jobs available. China is not only the world's largest gold producer, but last year imported as much gold as the world produced. It's been said that imitation is the highest form of flattery, while investors will be rewarded for mimicking China's passion for gold. Then Robert Ian wraps up the show with his latest must-hear report. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with the Market Weatherman report. Cloudy skies appeared over the precious metals markets this week on improved domestic economic reports, which reduced the risk trade in favor of risk-off strategies, sending money flows into the U.S. equity sector. Plus, signs of easing tensions in the Ukraine, at least in the near term, further lowered demand for safe haven investments. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, gold was only off about 42 points, though, finishing at $1,250, a solid close. The yellow metal is still higher for the year by nearly 2%. Silver lost 62%, finishing at $1,882, but still well above support. Palladium added $6, bucking the trend, closing at $836 on continued tensions between the West and Russia. Platinum finished at $1,454, off $22 in South Africa. Labor talks will continue this weekend in an attempt to end the 19-week-long strike. And West Texas Intermediate crude dropped $2 as Russia reportedly removed many of their troops from the Ukrainian border. It finished off about $1.50, still though above $1.02 per barrel. Well, the top story driving the markets this week, improved domestic economic reports underpinning the U.S. equity rally and signs of easing tensions in Ukraine. U.S. durable goods orders rose in April, indicating solid manufacturing, which caught analysts and investors off guard. The initial weekly jobless claims dropped 27,000 to 300,000. The Fed pared its monthly asset purchases to about $45 billion in April, its fourth straight $10 billion cut. Plus, Russia pulled back most of its troops from the border with Ukraine. Prices also fell, as Ukraine's president-elect vowed to step up operations to curtail separatist actions in the east of the country. The combination significantly reduced investors' interest in safe haven investments. Nevertheless, this month's gold-backed ETFs did climb to a new record. Analysts at Citigroup also noted on Thursday that gold prices should average about $1,337 an ounce, about $100 higher from where they currently stand, due to the ongoing Russia-Ukraine tensions. Despite the temporary lull in the Ukraine, heightened geopolitical risks and solid global demand are still cited as important and key factors for higher prices this year by the World Gold Council. Plus, Indian gold demand is expected to climb, which in turn could boost the price due to the lift of import duties thanks to the newly elected government. In addition, currency wars are ratcheting up, including the dumping of the largest number of U.S. treasuries by Russia, while the central bank bought 28 tons of gold, almost $1.4 billion worth, just last month. Russian President Putin says that Russia and China must secure their gold and foreign exchange reserves as China prepares to launch another physical gold exchange. Plus, Russia and China also announced a natural gas deal worth about $500 billion using their currencies exclusively, which in turn reduces demand for our U.S. dollar. China is demanding the de-Americanization of the world and China. Russia, Iran, and 21 other nations signed an agreement as an indication of unity. Therefore, although the market is vulnerable to further sell-offs, the smart money appears to be using these discounted price opportunities as a once-in-a-lifetime chance to increase gold and silver stockpiles. Bottom line on the precious metals. Well, as suggested in last week's Alpha Stocks newsletter, weakness did come to pass this week. You'll want to log in on Monday for an important gold and silver market update, forecasts, and of course, all the stock picks. In fact, this week, one of our best picks, and almost all of them rocketed higher, was a gas company. I've been telling people for years that the U.S. is the Saudi Arabia of natural gas. We have it, well, frankly, coming out of our ears. So when the Ukraine was attacked, it didn't take too many gray cells to recognize that the top exporter of natural gas through their pipelines to Europe is the Ukraine. So clearly the U.S. could become a major supplier to Europe. And very few companies other than the stock that I posted on Thursday has major shipping operations. And this is due to the fact, a little known fact, that gas must be held at around 270 degrees below zero. I mean, you have to approach absolute zero. And if it rises just a few degrees, well, in fact, it shrinks the density of natural gas roughly 800% as you approach that cold level. So this stock literally exploded on Friday, just hours after being posted, as many of our stocks did this week. It was just a no-brainer. So I'd like to encourage everyone who hasn't yet signed up, you know, you can do so virtually risk-free. You can do a monthly subscription or the annual subscription, which is by far the best bargain. And then there are lifetime subscriptions, 5-year, that's up to you. All right, moving on. To the Wall Street Report, visibility was virtually unlimited over the New York Stock Exchange for the second week running, with two top benchmark indices, the Dow Jones and S&P 500, finishing at the highest points in American history. For the week, the Dow was up 110 points, finishing at 16,717. The S&P added 23 points, wrapping up at 1923, while the NASDAQ added 56, finishing at 4242. Friday capped the S&P 500 index's fourth consecutive monthly advance to all-time record highs, thanks to steady improvement in the domestic economy, including employment, manufacturing, and inflation. Merger activity bodes well for the bulls. Pharmaceutical manufacturer Allergan leaped over 5% on news that Valeant Pharmaceuticals increased its offer to purchase the company. Elsewhere, the Commerce Department reported U.S. consumer spending fell about 0.1% in April. That was lower than expected. In April, personal income rose 0.3%, also lower than anticipated. The Federal Reserve's favorite indication of inflation rose 0.2%, as expected, and the Thomson Reuters and University of Michigan Consumer Sentiment Index indicated a final reading of 81.9, and that was better than expected, another sign of solid economic growth. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, our favorite 7-component sentiment index, Pendulum, has moved back into the neutral category this week, despite the obvious breakout to new highs. So you would have expected, if folks were savvy investors, that this index would be rocketing up into the greedy levels, because we've had two really good weeks of breakout now in the S&P and the Dow. So it appears that many investors are still complacent on the sidelines, perhaps due in part to the summer months, vacation activity, plans that people have, as well as geopolitical risks. And a lot of people are still nervous about stocks after 2008, if you can believe that. Here we are in probably one of the, what will be viewed as one of the greatest bull markets of all time, 5-6 years running. Nevertheless, this is great news for the bulls, because nervous herds make stampedes to higher levels all that much easier. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com radio with Bob Hoy and Gerald Celente. So why don't you stay with us here at GoldSeek? As editor-in-chief investment strategist of institutionaladvisors.com, Bob Hoy brings a wealth of economic knowledge to the table. He's well-versed not only in market history and current events, but also the technical situation. Welcome back, Bob Hoy.
Chris, good to be with you, and good to be with your listeners.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you back with us. And, you know, for the year, gold is still higher by nearly 5%. We've seen a marked improvement over last year, but some of the wind seems to have left its sails.
That's appropriate description, Chris. Now, as we speak here, I'm just just about finished our market letter for tomorrow, and we always do the gold section last, so I'm focused on it. And we can do the big picture, and that is that the problems in gold have sort of been on for a couple of years, while there has been no problems in stock and bond markets. So the big markets have been very popular, and the degree of speculation in the stock market and in lower-grade bonds is, well, particularly lower-grade bonds, the action there is without precedent. And then you've never, ever had the Federal Reserve buying lower-grade bonds, like they've been buying the subprime mortgage bond, which is a disaster issue. And with that, you've got underperformance on the precious metal side. So what we want to look back is on the nearer term, going into last November, we saw the base metals, the grains, and the precious metals all under some pressure, and thought that this was getting oversold. Maybe these things, that whole set, could bottom around December and then move up for a good rally into March. And we call it the big rotation, and indeed it worked out rather well. Like, the grains were slow to get going. They didn't bottom until January. And then the base metals, largely due to copper's problems, had a very fast rally out of end of November, a sharp rally, and then packed it in because there's a lot of problem with Chinese investors in copper and in iron. So that was brief. So all of these rallies were sharp when they came. We enjoyed them, but we said when they got overbought that we'd take money off the table because threatening the markets has this buildup of huge speculation in financial assets, and that then is a problem. So then on the going back to the bigger picture on all of the great financial bubbles, like all the way back to 1720, which are once in every other or couple of generations event. So the last big bubble was 1929, and then there was the one that blew out in 2007. But the long history of that, Chris, is that you take the real price of gold, you know, divided by the CPI or by the wholesale price index, and it sets an important low as the speculation and paper blows out, and then gold's real price goes up on the first recession after the bubble and the crash. So, and this is what we've had recently here started out of the crash, because I'm just looking at now at the Huey divided by the S&P, and it went down in 2000 in that big crazy tech bubble, and then with the crash and that, it sorted itself up and went up. So, and then it turned into a decade-long bull market for gold. There were two things going on there, Chris. One was the improvement in the real price, and then the other was the rising in the dollar price. And that then set the trap where you went into 2011, and that was when the European Bank announced it was going to buy bonds forever and that sort of stuff. And the whole of the central bank system got pretty reckless. So that's when the reckless really got started. So then you had, in any of that kind of a bull market where gold and silver are going up, silver will always outperform gold. And we keep track of the silver-gold ratio. And in 2011, that ratio on the momentum on it, which we call the RSI, it got up to 92. So we look back in history to see when the last time it got up to 92, and that was in January of 1980 when silver hit $48 and gold was up to 850 or whatever it was, on that attempt by the Hunt brothers to corner silver, and they briefly drove the gold-silver ratio down to 16. So, and it collapsed. So then in 2011, we pointed out that this degree of, because it was a measure of the degree of speculation in silver and in gold, and it got to a dangerous condition, which we pointed out and said that the subsequent, you know, getting out of that overbought condition wouldn't be as bad as what followed 1980, but it would be uncomfortable. So we got the first sell-off there, and then in 2012, the gold and silver took off, and you had a good rally right into September. Now, that was the one where you then had Bernanke come up and say that they were going to start the bond buying program. That was about September the 8th or something like that. And that was the precious metal community bet on that the central bank of the U.S. buying bonds would drive the dollar down and drive the price of gold up. But what happened then is that the silver-gold ratio got up to 84, and we pointed out that that was dangerous and there would be a setback in the precious metals. And honestly, Chris, at that time in October, I didn't really believe that the bond buying would be as effective as it's been. I thought they would kind of get buried in low-grade bonds. But nonetheless, you ended up with a cyclical business expansion and a cyclical credit market where credit conditions became very speculative. But again, in hindsight, we missed it. It would have been better to buy junk bonds at that time because that's what's turned out. So here we are. But we're at the other end of that, Chris, now, where the junk bond market has become a lot. It's now run for almost a year without any serious correction. And the S&P has run for more than about a year without serious correction. So it is complacency and low volatility. So, and you've also got the rebound here in gold, which we said that one would take money off the table on. We're getting close to reemploying that, but this would be in gold only because on a post-bubble contraction, in which we've seen the first business expansion in that, and it's now at 5 years becoming mature. The senior stock market at 5 years bull market is becoming mature. So then as this rolls over, and so will the credit markets, but the bonds will roll over as well, then that will allow gold to rally. But in a post-bubble environment, gold will a lot of the time outperform silver. We don't want to look at supply-demand considerations here because at any year I'm told that the consumption of silver is greater than the production of silver. But we're looking at the gold and silver in a financial sense, not a supply and demand sense. And in a post-bubble contraction, the really safe, careful money goes to the most liquid items, and that is T-bills in the senior currency. The U.S. dollar is still the senior currency. And it also goes to the unique liquidity of gold. So, and that would be, no matter what currency you're in, you're going to find gold, a reason to buy gold is just that it's a safe place to be. So you're going to end up with the world where you've got gold rising in most important currencies. And so you get into the world where the equation is not that the U.S. dollar is awful, the Federal Reserve is awful, and then the dollar goes down and then that moves gold up. That is not the case. We could go into a period where the dollar is firming relative to a number of currencies. And if the demand for gold, the investment demand for gold is still increasing, then the price of gold in U.S. dollars could go up. It could be going up in other currencies as well. The other one that the people on the supply-demand side of gold focus on is jewelry consumption, particularly the World Gold Council does. So what you have in a boom is you have an increase in jewelry consumption and offtake, but you don't have much of a demand for by investors. The investment demand diminishes because the investors are all playing in the stock and bond market. But then when you go into the contraction and the bad times for general, then the investment demand for gold comes in as, ironically, in a bust, nobody's going to buy any jewelry. That was the case after 1929. And even after 1929, the De Beers market control on diamonds fell apart for a while, mainly because there was no jewelry demand. So here we are. We're at the ending part of a five-year bull market out of a classic crash. It's been a five-year recovery in the economy. It's not been a strong recovery. As a matter of fact, even the establishment says that it has been the weakest recovery since the 1930s. I think that Mother Nature trying to tell us something. And so with this weak recovery, you don't need a huge powerhouse move in the economy to end it. It can just quietly end as credit markets change. So here's our stance on the normal investment world of stocks and bonds and economy is that economic numbers and business reports, earnings and stuff, would likely be positive, weakly positive, but positive until the stock market ended. And then once the stock market rolls over, then the positive stuff would roll over as well. If there was a time when there was a normal business cycle, and as you and I know, the stock market would peak 10 to 12 months before the economy would. So it was a leading indicator. And establishment economists have created an index of leading indicators, and one of which is the stock market. But when you get into a world of financial bubbles, and when the bubble failed in 2007, it took the economy with it right away, which was the case in 29 as well. So here's our thesis, and then also at bottoms, the stock market leads the recovery in the business cycle, but not so much on this one because the crash ended in March of 09, and the business cycle recovery, they nailed it down as June of 09, so that was pretty close. So they're going the other way now as the long five-year business expansion rolls over, and the stocks, we think it all roll over at the same time, which then, as it go around in circles again, allows gold to go up because of its unique liquidity. If you're getting hammered in lower-grade bonds and subprime mortgage bonds like the Fed's been buying, the safe money and the concerned money and the conservative money will go to gold. So first of all, we would look for a rally in gold with gold outperforming silver. And if you get into heavy liquidation in the stock market, it'll take some of the gold stocks down with it. So we'd be a little cautious on that side. So what can we say to look for as a sign to increase positions in gold? Well, it would be having the S&P take out an important support point. I'm not looking at the chart now, so I don't know where it'll be. You'd also have the credit spreads widening. That's the difference between the yield for low-grade bonds and high-grade bonds. There's been some of that. That's been on for a couple of months now, and actually 2 weeks ago, the spread between junk and TLT, that's between junk bonds and treasuries, did actually break down, which we take as a serious warning on the end of the party in the financial markets, and then with that, that would be a warning on the beginning of the better times for gold. So,
well, I think that's an excellent synopsis of what's going on here. Interesting slant on the markets. And speaking of gold, you know, I'd like your comments on demand for gold. You touched on it a bit with the jewelry demand, but, you know, it's expected to increase now that the Reserve Bank of India has loosened restrictions on imports. Shipments will expand as much as 50% from here on out. Now that their balance of payment is back to equilibrium, analysts are calling for an end of the current 10% import duty on gold, and this will, of course, cause premiums to have in India. So we could see a huge spike in demand, and I'd like your thoughts.
That's an important sidebar on the whole thing, is that, and of course, the main thing is that the investment demand for gold would improve based upon stocks and bonds heading south. And that's, you know, that's an ancient pattern now, and that goes way back. So this, then India beginning to relax things, and the that would be part of the bigger pattern.
Exactly. So, you know, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on this story that a major bank in Britain received a stiff fine of $44 million last week by British regulators, and this is apparently regarding price rigging on gold. I'd like your thoughts on the manipulation aspects of the market and whether or not you think this could be at least one of the dominoes leading to the end of market manipulation there.
Not too much of a into conspiracies on market manipulations by central banks or other vested interests, but I will say that throughout a whole lot of financial history, you probably have had at any time a couple of dealers on in the gold pool, as they used to call it, who are interested in pushing whatever trend is on for just a little further. You know, like a uptrend, let's squeeze the shorts. On a downtrend, let's shake out the weak hands. But as to any serious or extended conspiracy against gold, now I don't go for it. It's playing its role in the financial markets and doing what it does. Like it, the real price of gold goes down in a bubble and then it goes up in the post-bubble contractions.
Unlike many paper assets where they are highly regulated, you know, the stock market has clearing houses. For the most part, you can sell gold and silver right on eBay. If you start to talk about manipulating the precious metals, then tell me why we're not seeing a huge dislocation on eBay and other free markets.
Your sidebar on eBay is really fascinating because I remember, who was it in the late 60s, early 70s or something like that, when someone in San Francisco tried to set up a small gold exchange? And I think they actually got going, and there was some transmission, and then, of course, the authorities stomped on that one. They didn't want to. That must have been late 60s. So anyways, now eBay, trading gold, and the authorities are not looking at it at all. Now, the other one here on London metal markets is that they're talking about ending up the price fixing for silver. Did you see that?
You know, I did. Actually, I did read
there's
a brief note.
There's something going around whether about ending the, because you've got.
They have announced the official end of a group that is actually called the London Silver Price Fix. And you are correct, and there's been considerable conjecture over whether or not that will spill over into the gold fix.
Well, I think it's a great idea to stop the fix. Now, when you had much smaller markets, you know, a few hundred years ago, and London was the financial center of the world. Okay, so they elected to trade silver and trade gold on this fix, a couple of fixes a day and that sort of stuff. But now in this world where you have not only the commodity, you know, the known commodity exchanges, you got all kinds of things trading out there, you know, all kinds of different exchanges for the basic New York stocks that are listed and institutional trading, that sort of thing. I can't think of any of the names of them now. But it seems to me practical to end some sort of a fixing arrangement. And I'm sure that their price fixes were all legitimate, straight up, and they balanced their orders that way, matched orders, and said that will clear the market and talk to the buyers and talk to the sellers, and they agreed. Okay, fine. But hell, there are much more in-depth markets out there, as I say, with not just only with the commodities exchanges, but on transactions done otherwise, you know, computers and all that sort of stuff. And as you point out, eBay, Craigslist.
According to a couple of analysts I listened to last week, we're looking for a potential downward trajectory no later than the end of this year. Charles Nenner and John Williams of Shadow Stats are calling for, well, especially Williams, total dollar destruction by no later than 2016. Williams is saying that the U.S. dollar will be 100%, not 99%, worthless, losing all of its purchasing power. Do you share a modicum of this outlook?
You have to back up on this, and there's a great deal of commotion about the Federal Reserve and its habit of currency depreciation. They think it's great. Keynes told them that depreciating the dollar against gold was good, and it wouldn't cause inflation. And then you had the post-Keynesians all say that their easing of credit doesn't cause inflation. It's the public with their inflation expectations. Well, it's all nonsense. What you've got here is that on each of the booms for the last 100 years, generally, the dollar is weak against stock prices or bond prices, whatever the boom is in, or it may be in base metal prices. And then, of course, you had the frustration of, for so many decades, Americans not being able to own gold. And then that was changed in beginning in 1975. But you've still had the frustration of watching a nonsensical, or the central bank, the Federal Reserve, becoming absolutely absurd with their ideas of it. I called it a oneness. There's only the Fed thinks that there's only one thing that conditions the economy and the financial markets, and that is the dollar. And although they say they ease credit, what they're meaning is they depreciate the dollar. So we'll say that it's been 100 years of complete idiocy. But each of the good times has been associated with a declining dollar. Look at how much fun it was when gold went to, in 1980, when you had that, you know, big, huge blow-off. It was fabulous. And then you had also in 1980, you had Reagan win the election, and one of his platforms was they weren't going to, depreciation of the dollar was not good, so you had the Reagan dollar, and it went up to whatever it went to in 1985. But the lesson is that with dollar depreciation, assets go up. And when assets go down, which is the bad times, the dollar goes up. So I cannot understand, well, I do understand how the gold community have this fixation that that the dollar is going to go to zero. Sure, I have a regard for the research and all of the services that John Williams provides, but he's an inflationist, and you just cannot, if you look at 100 years of history in the United States, you cannot come to the conclusion that a falling dollar is bad times. Falling dollar, here you've had since, let's see, since 09, you've had the dollar generally decline since it rose with the crash, with the rise to 84, 85, the DX did. It rose with the crash. And this is where in 08, the gold community was offside. You could tell in the summer of 08 that, the bottom was going to fall out of the stock markets in the fall. And they all came in with the idea that this time the dollar goes to zero with the, and the disaster. But no, the dollar went up. And the reason why the dollar goes up in a post-bubble contraction is that during the bubble, most of the debt written and contracted is in the world's financial capital, which used to be London. And then lately, along all the booms we've had for the last 50 years, it's been New York. So then all the debt that's written out there to lesser countries and lesser corporations and everything else is and a whole lot of it is due and payable in U.S. dollars in New York. So then once the bubble, financial bubble is over, then all of those offside borrowers get very sincere about meeting their obligations in New York. So they end up selling a whole lot of copper cheap and base metals and crude oil and everything else in order to get their hands on dollars to service their obligations in New York. So then the bubble, the financial part of the bubble, the debt bubble, is in effect becomes an immense short position in dollars that takes a long time to cover. So each of the post-bubble contractions has been, it's called a contraction because credit contracts. People realize that, hey, you don't want to owe money. You pay it off. So the outlook for what I say is that the throughout history, that in the post-bubble contraction, the senior currency becomes chronically firm against most other currencies and most commodities for most of the time. And so far, you had the low with the dollar index at 72 with the bubble that completed in 2007, and I think about that. And it ain't going down like the dollar bears think it should be. It's only just declined from 84 to 78 point something a little while ago, and now it's recovered. And what we wrote last week is that if the dollar gets DX index gets above, it had to get through 80.5, and it closed at 80.6. So it has set the next uptrend, and just I think another handle higher, it'll get pretty exciting out there. And I think also that, and your question was direct, that some of these people think that the worst thing that can happen is that the dollar goes down. I think that's a built-up opinion over decades that the Fed is stupid, and I agree. And I think that in this form of thinking that the severest reprimand you could have on the Fed would be the dollar going to zero. But I don't think the dollar is going to go to zero. I think that we've had a wonderful financial party for the last few years as the dollar was somewhat weaker. And then now, and you've had just in this week, we looked at the euro bonds. And the speculation there has been unbelievable. So we thought a Spanish bond was a good one to follow. And its decline in yield has been fabulous. And for 4 weeks in a row, it registered a downside capitulation on our model. And then more recently, last week, the Italian bond, the decline in yields was strong enough to register a capitulation as well. And here we also are in the month of May. Now, it's a long tradition amongst bond traders that if you have a hot bond market going into May, you can have a reversal. And so we're watching for the reversal here now. It isn't on, but it's trying, and you have exceptional technical readings on it. So this is the best for the party in stocks and bonds. And as it rolls over, the dollar will go up. And it's interesting that today, technically, the dollar took a step in setting the uptrend. So our view, in a nutshell, Chris, is that the financial markets, stocks, and lower-grade bonds are on the verge of a bear market, and that as this comes in, the U.S. dollar will go up, and because the whole world hates it and is short it. And mainly, you know, you shouldn't transmit your hate of a central bank to the currency. It's trading as it is. And also keep in mind that the guys at the Federal Reserve really depend on their ability to depreciate the dollar. So I think they're going to be surprised. I think the gold bugs are going to be surprised. And we would I think the next few days on both the bond markets and on the dollar index will tell the tale. But I was very pleased to see the dollar index rise above that resistance at 80.5, and it was 80.6. So my view, Chris, is that dollar up, overinflated asset prices down. The asset prices for gold are not overinflated; they're bottoming. Sentiment and momentum figures for gold are bottoming, and that gold would lead will go up. It could go up with a steadier dollar, but on any day that the dollar goes up fast, of course they'll set gold back, but. But we would not yet begin to buy gold stocks. And one of the signals on this whole financial market turning nasty will be one day we'll come in and the board will open up and silver will be down a whole lot relative to gold. And that has happened many times before because in a post-bubble contraction, the gold-silver ratio goes up. Let's see, in the Depression in the 1840s, it got out to 35. And then in the 1930s Depression, I haven't got the thing in front of me, but I think it was around 45. And then on the Great Promotion in 1980, they got it down to 16 for a bit. And then you spent the 1990s getting out of, the banks had all those commodities and gold and silver and oil loans and everything. It was a complete disaster. So that the 1980s was a serious contraction, such that at the end of 1990, going into the 1990, the Federal Reserve had to bail out Chase Manhattan and Citigroup, the two big banks. And at that point, I think it was December 1990, the gold-silver ratio got to 103. So here we are now. The gold ratio is hanging around 66. And I'm looking at the chart. If it gets above 68, then that ratio is going up. That sets the uptrend. And at similar points in 2008, when the gold-silver ratio broke out beyond resistance of the last 6 or 8 months, that, like in 08 when it did it, that signaled that the stock market was going to fail. So here now, the gold-silver ratio goes up, this time the level 68 or so, goes through there, it says that the stock and bond markets are going to fail. So what we do, Chris, is we let financial history tell us what's going on rather than taking a position and telling the markets what they should be doing. And then when it doesn't happen, coming up with a conspiracy figure that governments are powerful enough to push markets. So.
That's right. You have to fit your theories to the facts, not the facts to your theories.
Yeah, that's for sure.
You think there's an interesting correlation between that breakout and the equities markets if you go back to at least 2008?
If you take the gold-silver ratio for the last 300 years, and even in England, well, you got to be careful there because they ran a long period of time when they kept tight bimetallic standard and they kept it fairly close to 16 for a long time. But when you're in a more uncontrolled market, the tendency is that when the gold silver rate, if you've been in any kind of a bull market for any asset price, when the gold silver ratio turns up, that's the warning signal. So, yeah. Or as we do it the other way around, when you're in a bull market for silver and gold, and when the silver-gold ratio goes crazy and sets a very high RSI, you got a problem. Well, you haven't got a problem, but it does. It marks the end of speculation. For example, in 1980, and this is hindsight, the gold silver ratio, the silver gold ratio set its high 3 weeks before the silver and gold actually set their high prices. So the change in the silver ratio, silver-gold ratio, gave the warning on the end of that fabulous bubble in precious metals.
It looks as though you're expecting for stocks and bonds, which have had just an incredible five-year run in bonds, I don't know, feels like 50 years, toppiness there in the months ahead, and that could set the stage for a dollar rally and maybe a bottom for gold and silver and some good prices there.
Yep. That's about roughly it, Chris.
Very good. Well, Bob Hoy, always a pleasure. We're going to look to having you back on the show with more insightful comments.
Anytime, Chris.
Gerald Celente is director of the Trends Research Institute. His team produces the Trends Journal, slam-packed with must-read information. Welcome back, Gerald Celente.
Well, thanks for having me back, Chris.
You know, Zeke West sent over a copy of your latest Trends Journal, as I mentioned here. I'm going to put it euphemistically, alarming trends here that everyone needs to be aware of. Overriding theme in your journal seems to be war. And you know, our top guests on this show have recently all been alluding to the threat of just that beginning no later than perhaps the end of this year or 2015. Tell us your thoughts here, please.
It's hard to say when and how, but the why is pretty clear. And the why is something I've been writing about for years when the Panic of 08 began. I said there would never be a recovery, there'd be a cover-up. And they would cover it up with schemes undreamed of. And those schemes undreamed of were record-low interest rates like we've never seen in our lifetime. Those schemes undreamed of with quantitative easing, not only in the United States. They have their own version in China and the European Central Bank as well. And then I said, when all else fails, they take you to war. It's a repeat of history. It never repeats itself exactly the same, but you have depressions, and then you have trade wars and currency wars, and then world wars. And in between that, you have a lot of regional scrimmages and civil wars. And that's what you're seeing breaking out now. In our Globalnomics section of the Trends Journal, we show the hot spots around the world. And they're all identified for everyone that wants to see them. And then what we did was we took the four corners of the world and we showed how it's all being waged around all of this, some of it making news and some of it not. So, of course, one of the ones was Ukraine. Another one we picked was Thailand. Hey, they had a military coup there, son of a gun. How do we know that was going to happen? Well, we've been watching it for several months now, and we wrote several months ago when it began that there'd be a military coup followed by a civil war. And then we wrote about Venezuela. Oh, today, news came out. Venezuela says that the United States has a plot to assassinate the president. And they have demonstrations going on there quite frequently. And they're running an inflation rate, I believe it's about 30-something percent. And then you look, the other one we picked was Nigeria. Wow, and that was long before the girls, the missing girls, the 300 or so girls that have been making the news. Why did we pick Nigeria? Well, because in Africa you have a lot of destabilization, a former colony of the European colony that was turned over again to a bunch of gangsters. They call themselves prime ministers or whatever, and kings and this and that. And they have 174 million people sitting on a lot of oil, and 40% of the people are making under a dollar a day. And so you could call them radical Islamists. You call them anything you want that are fighting against the corrupt government, but very easy to see. And then, of course, you start putting the pieces together. Thailand, Ukraine, Nigeria, Venezuela, Yemen, Somalia. You keep going around, Syria. And you can see it's a world in the throes of war, but that's not all of it. It's also the demonstrations that are going on in Italy and in Greece and in Spain and in Portugal that don't make the news here. Hey, did they find that airplane yet? You know, that one that they heard the pinger again for the 100th time that CNN's been covering as a feature story even this week. So people don't see the dangers of what's going on. And as we tie it all together, Chris, we keep ending the story with, when people lose everything and have nothing left to lose, they lose it. And the other one is, far too few have much too much, and way too many have far too little. And that's what you're seeing going on around the world. They could call it anything they want, terrorism, fundamentalism. It's all comes down to the bottom line, and the bottom line is, you got a lot of people out of work with nothing to lose, and they're losing it.
People want answers. They want to know what is at the root of this. I mean, on one hand, you say, well, you know, morally, we become bankrupt. We're not based in the traditions of the past. On the other hand, we have folks who point to economics. As soon as you let the monetary, the Keynesian genie out of the bottle, all of your money becomes debased. It is the first time in history that there hasn't been a single global currency backed by anything of substance. And eventually, that erodes all the confidence, and a few elite people at the top of the pyramid wind up with all the change, and the rest of us, we're left holding the mortgages and the paper. Is that how we got here, or is that an oversimplification?
No, it's not an oversimplification, but it's part of it, because then you have in other countries where that's not the issue. So it could be Egypt, it could be Colombia, it could be Venezuela or Argentina. So you have corruption. To me, morals, you know, I have to say it's the issue because it also gravitates to other levels. For example, back here in the States, President Obama just announced $5 billion for an anti-terrorism partnership with our allies. Oh, $5 billion. I read the same day they're going to take down 40,000, that's right, 40,000 structures, old factories and houses in Detroit. They're going to destroy them.
Just take a look at Detroit from any angle. You know, one worries if it isn't the Petri dish representing the rest of the nation here.
That's what I'm saying. Now, why is Detroit, what has happened to Detroit? You can't blame it on one thing or one person. It's a combination of unions and a combination of selling out our manufacturing, which they continue to do under the guise of NAFTA and the World Trade Organization, that allows companies to get products made in slave labor companies, mark up the prices, and bring them back home and resell them. And labor unions with these ridiculous things that they had with the auto industry and producing inferior cars. Hey, did you get your General Motors car recalled yet? I mean, look what's going on. And then the other point of this is the military. I don't support the troops. I want to make that clear. I am an American patriot. I'm here in Colonial Kingston, New York. I support a national defense force, not foreign entanglements. I do not support troops going to Afghanistan, to Yemen. Now they're sending them into Chad, into Nigeria. I don't approve of them going to Iraq. I don't approve of them going to Syria. I want a defense force. I am an American that stands on the principles upon which this nation was founded. No foreign entanglements. No foreign entanglements. They were going on back then. with a 100 years war, this war, that war, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Adams, Franklin, all of the founding fathers, no foreign entanglements. So when you want to talk about the other part of this, Chris, listen to the words of General Dwight D. Eisenhower, five-star general, supreme commander of the Allied forces in World War II, and, for the record, a two-term president. He warns the nation that the military-industrial complex is robbing the nation of the genius of the scientists, the sweat of the laborers, and the future of the children. How much more proof do people need? When you look at the defense budget with NSA watching us, CIA listening to us, FBI tracking us, and you put it all together, you're at well over $1 trillion a year, getting flushed down the toilet. As Major General Smedley Butler, the most decorated man in American history before his death, warned, he said that war is a racket, and that's what it's become. So we could look at the other issues, the economic issues, but we have to look at what's happened to this nation. Look at the scandal going on now with the Veterans Administration. They use these poor people for cannon fodder, then they bring them back and they screw them. How much more is this? And look at the size of the budget for the VA. Look what we're doing to our soldiers, bringing them into foreign countries, into losing wars, coming back either in a casket or without arms, legs, or a mind.
If you bring this topic up to people, it becomes emotionally charged. On the one hand, if we pull out of these countries, there's going to be nothing but worldwide global chaos, and that's going to come back. There's going to be blowback.
Well, let's stop at that. Let's just stop at that and answer that question. Look what they did in Iraq. We're not there anymore. Wait, pick up the paper every day. Go to antiwar.com. Look at the numbers. 104 dead, 97 dead, 220 dead, day after day. You want to talk about chaos? What did the United States do by going in there? Destabilize the area. Chaos? Hey, all of you people that want to answer the question, try this one on for size. Does Libya fit you well? You remember that humanitarian mission? Or to use the language from the White House, time-limited, scope-limited, kinetic action. Oh, yeah, you want to talk about destabilization since they overthrew Gaddafi? Hey, you want to know why there's problems in Mali? Want to know why there's problems in Nigeria? Want to know why there's problems in Sudan? Want to know why all of those weapons that are now going into Syria, into the hands, and they're not only Islamic radicals. There are thousands of mafia groups that want a piece of the action, that have grabbed a hold of the situation in the midst of the chaos. Look, you can't go to Libya now. They're closing down the embassies and telling the people to come home. You could go there under Gaddafi. He wasn't bothering anybody.
Really, what I wanted to touch on here, though, was I'd like to examine just what would happen if we decided to bring our troops home. I mean, there's something like, at last check, well over 100 military bases.
700.
700 military bases. And we're not talking little, McDonald's or Wendy's restaurants here. This takes a huge, vast network of wealth and resources that the taxpayer has to pay. But let's step back for a minute and let's pull our troops out, close down the 700 bases. Well, we're going to cause massive unemployment in the United States if we do that. Really? Are you so sure of that? What would start to happen over time? You know, would we suddenly have more folks at home to build up our economy who would also be better educated and have entrepreneurial ideas of their own? And would we not have a sea change of improved sentiment towards the United States from the rest of the world who says, hey, maybe these guys aren't a bunch of militaristic, bombastic monsters after all?
Yeah, I think you wrapped it up well, and I agree with you. One of the movements I'm starting, by the way, and it's in the Trends Journal, it's called Occupy Peace. And I want to make this clear, if anybody's ever watched my videos, you know, I do Trends in the News each night, each weekday night, and they're on YouTube. We paste them up there. I'm a close combat practitioner. I'm not a pacifist. And I don't start trouble, and I don't look for trouble. If somebody tries to attack me, I'll do what I have to do.
It's common sense. I mean, everybody's read Sun Tzu. I mean, what is it, 70 pages long? If you haven't read Sun Tzu, you can't be an investor. And you certainly can't be in business because, I mean, it's the basics of business. And you summed it up perfectly. I mean, he makes it very, very, very clear. You never go to war unless victory is assured and it's absolutely necessary.
And so here's what I'm coming up with. It's called OccupyPeace.us. Anybody could go to the website and sign up. We're just putting it in order now. But the site is up. And the purpose of this is it's based on three words. No foreign entanglements. Rebuild America. So now we close down all these bases. We bring the troops home. And now we close down our borders. I'm not xenophobic. I'm just non-interventionist. I'm not an isolationist. I travel the world. I believe in, you know, doing business with ever who you want to do business with. But I also believe we have too many people in this country, and we can't take care of our own right now, and we don't need any more. And all they're doing is driving down the wages by bringing in cheap labor, whether it's in the tech industry with their H-1B visas or bringing in other cheap labor. And when you look at the history of this country during the Depression up until well after World War II, the borders were closed. Very few were allowed to come in. We need to rebuild America. I don't want my money going to Israel. I don't want it going to Italy. And I'm of Italian descent. I don't want it going to Ireland. And I love Irish women. I don't want it going to Ukraine. I don't want it going anywhere. I want it going to America and Americans. I want it going to Camden. I want it going to Detroit. Look at our internet system. It is third world. Do you know we rank right near the bottom when it comes to internet service? Yeah. Foreign is, and we're the people that brought it to the forefront. And now look at our. You travel the world, you come back to JFK. Where do I land in Bangladesh? When you go to the other airports, look at our rail system. It's a disgrace.
No, the infrastructure is crumbling. And once again, you know, this is because, first of all, we've been misled by a media that is controlled by a few elite, okay? I mean, they have just bought up the media. Media oligarchy. When people get misled and they forget the important functions, they focus on these entanglements instead of focusing on the important aspects of society, like the infrastructure. I mean, look at what we did before the world wars. I mean, we had a Great Depression. What did we do? We're going to pull ourselves out of this Great Depression by building dams, by building bridges, by building interstate highways. Well, China is doing that right now. They are the quintessential Americans.
Do you know, I read in the Financial Times, I can't verify it, you know, and you know my motto, I always want to say this, I don't care if people agree or disagree with me, but the motto of the Trends Journal is think for yourself. These are the facts that we have, this is the way we see it, you use your own brain and you decide. So I read an article about 2 weeks ago in the Financial Times, and they had said that in 2 years, between 2010 and 2012, China used more cement to build infrastructure and real estate than the United States used in the entire 20th century.
There's an interesting offshoot to this discussion. Shouldn't, I think, just be passed over with complacency. It's the largest producer of the yellow metal of gold worldwide. But what people may not be aware of is that they imported the entire global output of gold last year. They don't export any gold on top of that. If they know something that we don't know, and they're certainly importing so much gold, are they preparing for a currency implosion?
I think that most intelligent people know that the currencies are backed by nothing and that we've had record low interest rates and there's going to be a financial panic of sorts when interest rates go up and the economies go down. The only thing, look, the GDP numbers came out for the last quarter, and they were in the negative territory. And you could blame it on the weather. And, well, you should. This is the worst winter back east that I've ever remembered in my life, and I'm no kid. But when you look at Europe, when you look at China, you have the Chinese housing market this year is down some 24%. There's no recovery in Europe. You look at the OECD forecast coming out, and they're showing negative growth. So even if the economy ticks up a little bit in the States on GDP growth, what's going to sustain it? Nothing. So what they're doing is they've debased the dollar by printing so many of them, and at record levels we've never seen before, with interest rates at all-time lows for never in the history of the country for this long. It's unprecedented.
Are you aware that there are more dollars circulating outside of our shores than within our shores, which I think is an incredible vulnerability should the world suddenly lose confidence? They seem to be doing every day in the U.S. dollar. You know, if we see a mass repatriation of those greenbacks,
well, you see, that's the problem. You have China's holding what? About 1.5 trillion of them. How do they turn them in?
Well, they buy up businesses. Yeah, they're going around the world right now buying up commodities and precious metals related, anything with substance to recycle away those dollars.
And that's what they're trying to do, and that's why one of the stories in the Winter Trends Journal was Chinatown, top trend for 2014, and they're buying up the world. And now you're looking at the United States, by the way, now trying to make a push into Africa because China's in there so deeply and keeps getting in deeper. And so the United States is now using this Nigeria incident as a reason, and AFRICOM, C-O-M, which should be AFRICON, it's the United States military now expanding bases in Africa. So, and then when I was talking about Libya before, let us not forget that there were over 30,000 Chinese working in the oil industry in Libya before President Obama, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, launched his, quote, humanitarian mission. So there's threats of China becoming more and more of a global economic power as the United States does the business of war. China is in the business of business.
Gerald, as we wrap up here, there are just so many pertinent topics today in the Trends Journal. Share whatever you see as most relevant for our listening audience, maybe any other socioeconomic trends that you'd like to leave today with the audience.
One is stay tuned what's going on in Ukraine. And there's no one I respect more geopolitically and economics is than Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, who was the former Assistant Treasury Secretary under Ronald Reagan. He's also a contributor to the Trends Journal. And I would suggest that anyone that wants to know the story of Ukraine, go to paulcraigroberts.org, as well as subscribing to the Trends Journal. Because all we're getting now is propaganda about Ukraine. There's a civil war going on. It's not going to have a happy ending. And it's destabilizing the region beyond just the Eastern European region. You already have a volatile situation economically in Europe. You don't need more destabilization. So I fear that this could spread out of control. And again, we have the timelines and how the propaganda has set it up to make this look like it was a Russian deal when, in fact, it was done by America. And the videos are all there of our Assistant Secretary of State, Victoria Nuland, on December 13, 2013, at the National Press Club, talking about how Ukraine has to follow the path of the IMF and that they're Europeans. And she has a sign right behind her, sponsored by Chevron, and then put the pieces together. just a week ago or so, we heard that our Hunter Biden, that's Vice President Biden's son, has been appointed to the largest energy company in Ukraine, Burisma Energy, B-U-R-I-S-M-A, along with Secretary of State John Kerry's stepson, Christopher Hines' business partner, Devon Archer, also appointed to Burisma Energy. So this thing is spinning out of control, and the bottom line, again, it looks like more dirty dealing on the level of how could I make a buck?
Well, you've heard the saying, follow the money. It sounds like follow the oil money.
Follow the oil money, and it's dripping right down into the White House. There should be outrage. Instead, the State Department says these are private citizens and they're highly qualified for these positions. So I figured out, sure, out of 7 billion people on Earth, Biden and Kerry's son-in-law's stepson's partner are the most qualified people out of 7 billion to be on Burisma's Energy's board of directors.
We always appreciate your thoughts here. It's cutting-edge stuff. It's the Trends Before the Trends Journal.
History before it happens.
And we're going to look forward to having you back on the show.
Thank you. And the website's trendsjournal.com.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with CunkerChange.com. Yellen has scant power to revive U.S. housing slowdown. U.S. mortgage application volume down 1.2% last week. And my own personal observation, looking at homes for sale on Zillow.com, has crystallized that certain homeowners are taking their last stab at denial to falling home prices by pricing their homes higher, in some cases significantly higher, than the Zillow estimate for comparable homes in their neighborhood. When you look at the same neighborhoods week after week online, you tend to memorize the prices of homes for sale in those areas. When something new comes online, it sticks out quickly. When new homes come online, you notice the price, especially how it relates to the current market dynamic. What I've noticed, and granted, this is only anecdotal observation in a small section of Nevada real estate, is that homeowners are listing their homes at higher prices, sometimes $25,000 to as much as $100,000 higher on $300,000 to $400,000 homes, compared to the estimates on similar homes in that neighborhood. Are there reasons these homes would be priced higher than the estimates? Of course. But I have spent many a Sunday of late going through for sale by owner open houses, and there is a definite dig-your-heels-in psychology amongst certain homeowners who want to sell, but missed the dead cat bounce of the past several years. They really did keep thinking that prices were going to continue to rise. They really did believe the reports mainstream media fed and continues to feed them in the background, which, by the way, was turned on in the background during several of the recent open houses I frequented with the TV on mute. The denial mechanism is very strong. It kept people believing we were in a recovering economy. Many still believe it. Some of those that broke free from that, at least to sell their houses, albeit late, have entered a different kind of denial. Price denial. The hope and prayer that maybe they can get more than what the market is really willing to pay at this juncture. Or, if they start high, maybe they can negotiate down to current levels instead of starting there. Whatever the reasoning, whatever the psychology, it's only going to become more chronic. As interest rates rise, as more houses come onto the market, as more people decide to sell, we're going to see more and more people take one last stab at denial before the next tidal wave of economic change levels the playing field for lots and lots of people all at the same time. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.